This is Richard, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Tara and myself, have the list of such groups and their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. June will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm June. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. Alcoholics Anonymous is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Perez will read the steps. Harris.
Hi, I'm Parrots. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 steps. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through a prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Eleanor will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Eleanor. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. These are the traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by an information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Pam.
Hi, I'm Pam, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. I am so very blessed to be here tonight, and Melissa, I don't know where you are, but thank you so very much for asking me to speak tonight. First, I'd like to say that the Atlantic Group is my home group, and Maria is my sponsor, and my sober date is June 5th, 2004. Yeah. To start, pretty much I was genetically screwed, and I, you know, had great chance of being an alcoholic because alcoholism ran in my family. And my entire life I had self-centered fear. So from my very first drink in 1975 to my last drink in 2004, I drank to get drunk. And I drank fast. It was all about, you know, drinking fast and getting drunk. And last year, after a 29-year drinking career, I pretty much had it with myself. I was at my wit's end. And over the last 10 years of my drinking career, I had tried everything imaginable to deny I was an alcoholic and control my drinking. And I finally had run out of ways to fail. And the last 4 years of my drinking, I was drinking every night. I was leading a double life. During the day, I was a very successful executive, and at night, I was an isolated alcoholic. And every night, I would go home, and I'd buy my bottle. Well, not every night. I'd buy a bottle that would last me a couple days. And I would drink in a certain amount that could get me through, and it was measured, it was controlled. I would drink in a certain amount, a certain time, and be able to get up and get to work by 9 o'clock in the morning and function all day. And soon I was drinking more than that amount, and the bottle wasn't lasting me 2 days, so I had to buy a bigger bottle. And I mean, I think I know, you know where this is leading. Unfortunately, I didn't know where it was leading, and I was drinking more, and I was measuring with measuring cups every night. I had a black marker that marked the bottle. I had a notepad that told me when I had to start and when I had to stop and how much I could drink so that I could get to work by 9 o'clock in the morning and function all day. And I wasn't getting to work by 9 o'clock in the morning and functioning anymore. And, you know, I was like a mad scientist and, you know, seemed normal to me to be doing this every day. But it wasn't so normal. And eventually I started to understand the meaning of a progressive disease. I never understood it before, and I certainly didn't ask what it meant because that would mean that I questioned myself and I didn't want anyone to know. I started to have blackouts in my last 2 years of my drinking. And the control freak that I was would take notes during those blackouts because my husband insisted that our arguments that we had during those blackouts were because of the alcohol was taking over, and I just insisted they were totally reasonable arguments. And the next morning, I would get up and I would read those notes, and they were totally incoherent. You just couldn't understand. I couldn't understand them. The other things that were happening to me were, you know, the red glazed eyes. But the final thing to me that meant that I was a real alcoholic was, you know, I started with the shakes. And at work, you know, I didn't want anyone to see that I had the shakes. I mean, that was instant alcoholism. Anyone could identify people with shakes were alcoholics. So I started taking Xanax to control the shakes so that no one knew that, you know, I was an alcoholic. And this went on. And I remember one night that my husband just got very emotional and broke down. And, you know, he just told me how much he loved me. And was so sad. And he was just saying he loved me so much. And he was afraid he was going to lose me and that I was going to die. And I just looked at him in the eyes and took another sip of my drink. And I had no soul. And this just went on and on. And finally, you know, one morning, you know, this would go on and on. And every morning I'd get up and say, I'm not going to drink. And every day in the afternoon, it's 4 o'clock. Here we go again. I'm planning my next drink for the night. And, you know, that is, you know, the definition of insanity, as I learned later on, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. You know, I thought I was going to be the one, as they said in the big book that was, you know, chapter 3, be the one who learned how to drink successfully. Well, I wasn't. One morning I woke up and I was on the phone with a very dear friend of mine and I said, I can't stop drinking on my own. I admitted to her I was an alcoholic and she convinced me to go to rehab. So I got on the phone with my therapist and he arranged for me to go. And although I was having a hair emergency that day and I wanted to go the next day, he convinced me to go that day. And I, you know, for once I listened to him and I said, oh, all right. While in rehab, which was the greatest thing I could have done for myself, I became the willing pupil, and the teacher appeared. This woman was the most wonderful woman in my life. I listened to everything she said. I wanted to be just like her. I wanted what she had. She could bring a group of recent detoxed drug addicts and alcoholics to serenity within 5 seconds. It was unbelievable. So I listened to everything she said. She said, you know, you got to get a sponsor, you got to find a home group, you got to work the steps, you got to find girlfriends, which I balked at. Didn't like girlfriends, but you know, I still listened to her. And when I left rehab, I stumbled across the Atlanta group by accident. And June started introducing me to some people, and everybody was so kind here to me. So it was a little big for me, but I decided to stay because everybody was so kind and polite, I thought it would be very rude if I had left. So, and my mother always taught me good manners. So I stuck in, and I stayed here, and, you know, it was a little long, too. The meeting was a little long. And after the meeting, I knew I had to get a sponsor, so Stephanie hooked me up with Marie, and it was really great. Marie was really great. Her requirements were very simple. She said, you know, I want you to call me every day. And we set up a certain time for her, you know, for me to call her. Now, had she not said, I want you to call me every day, I wouldn't have done that because I thought it would have been an imposition for me to call her. But she made it very, very simple for me. So we set up a time at 7 in the morning, boom, called, connected every day. It was simple. We started working on the steps immediately. She had me get a commitment, and she had me join the Atlantic group. And that made it just very simple for me. And since then, you know, I've worked the steps, and I will say that once I got to the fifth step, I really started to appreciate this program and understand it and start to reap the promises here. It was really, really wonderful. And, you know, I fought a lot with myself over the past year, I must say. I've had a lot of arguments in my head, you know, like, oh, I don't want to go to the meeting, go to the meeting, don't go to the meeting, go to the meeting. And I realized that, you know, Pam, all these years it never really worked your way. Just shut up and do it their way for once, because they say it'll work, just do it already. And I got to tell you something, you know, it worked. So I'm really glad that I listened to them this year, because it's been quite a rewarding year for me. You know, so many wonderful things have happened to me. I even made it to my first year the right way. And I have to say to the newcomer, if you're here tonight, you know, please stick around, because the Atlantic group is a really, really great group. We've got great sponsorship here. And if you look around the church here, there is absolutely somebody for everybody here. And if you don't pick one of us, we'll come after you and pick you. We'll trip over ourselves trying to get to you. I'll tell you a little quick God story. On my way home from my anniversary watch the other night, my husband and I are walking home, beautiful night, and this drunken homeless man comes out of nowhere, running down the street, bumps into us, and I looked at my husband and I said, oh my God, that could have been me. And we were so blessed. This was a warning from God, and I just thank God for my sobriety. In closing, I'd just like to thank my husband so very much for sticking with me and seeing something in me that I didn't see. He thought there was something to stick around for. I'd also like to thank my sponsor, Marie, for guiding me through the steps and sticking with me this year, my grand sponsor, Joan and Peggy, my great-grand sponsor, my sober sister, Beth, and all you at the Atlantic Group. You're so wonderful, all your hugs and kisses and kindness this year. I mean, this is so wonderful here. Your love and everything, everything here has kept me sober one day at a time. Thank you so much for everything.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Steve.
I'm Steve. I'm an alcoholic. I was kind of hoping that 10 minutes would last a little longer, Pam, but it didn't. My home group's a little bit different. There's about 30 people in it, so this is a little bit different. And this is about the turnout the Mets got the other night, so it can't be that bad. I just want to thank the Atlantic Group for having me, James, and I've been coming around here for a couple months. My girlfriend's in this group, and you guys have, it is a great group, and you guys have good fellowship, and a lot of you guys do a lot of action, too, and I've seen it with my own eyes, and especially the watches and stuff. What it was like. My parents are baby boomers, and they're from Fordham Road, and they took that with them to Westchester County, and that's where I was born. And I tell you, they like to drink. And I have an older brother. He's about 7 years older than I am. And I just remember, I was about 12 or 13, and he was taking me to keg parties with him, and I just thought I was the coolest guy out. And, I couldn't even, forget about where I was standing. But, I was drinking then. And, I wanted to fit in. And, that's where it went. And, I started experimenting with hard alcohol. I started drinking Wild Turkey. And, I loved it. And it was a lot faster than beer was. Especially, I didn't have... In high school, I worked at a restaurant, and they didn't pay me too good. So I was drinking Meisterbrau and Schlitz Ice. And I decided to get to hard alcohol. It was faster, and it was a little cheaper. Every time I picked up a drink, it was always some kind of catastrophe. I don't want to tell any war stories. One time I picked up a drink, and I was running up the stairs like Sylvester Stallone in Philadelphia. And I don't even remember how I got there. And that's where alcohol led me. It took me, places I never want to go. And I also, missed my education with alcohol. I got too hungover, and I decided, I couldn't make it to my SATs or, junior year. Senior year, I made the same mistake. And, I always ran with an older crowd. So in high school, I was hanging out with guys who were 19 or, 20, and a couple guys from my grade. We were hanging out till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I had class at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I'm only 17 years old, and a couple of the teachers, they knew what the deal was, and they figured me out real fast, and because my older brother had a nice reputation too, and I guess they knew how I was going to turn out, and after high school, it really took off. It seemed like people were growing and they were doing things, and. I just felt like, I felt like a bum. But there was one thing I was good at, and that was drinking and blacking out. And I continued to keep doing that. A couple times, when I blacked out, I did things, I got arrested for. And, one particular night, I got arrested. I got pulled over. I was on foot. I wasn't driving. And, I was with my older brother. And we got into a little altercation together, and you know, the cop ended up putting his hands on me, and, you know, I didn't like that, and, you know, he ended up slamming me. I hate telling that, but, you know, that's what happened. And, you know, and the cop, I went to the court, and, you know, I didn't know what to think. You know, I thought it was just going to blow it over. You know, I was only 20 years old, 21 at the time. And, you know, the judge was sick and tired of seeing me. And, you know, he mandated me to AA. I was in a nice little courtroom in Larchmont, Westchester. So it was, you know, people there for parking too long or, and here I am. And, you know, the judge mandated me to AA. And, you know, I just remember that, you know, I took it as a joke, you know. And I remember I came home and I told my dad the big news, you know, like I was going to the army or something. I said, Dad, they're sending me to AA. And, he said, you know, those people, he didn't say, you know, he said, those people will stop drinking forever. And I was like, you know, that's good because I'm not going to stop drinking. So, you know, hopefully they do good with that. And, you know, I decided not to go. And, you know, I decided to hang out with the same crowd. And, you know, I was still, by this time, it was getting worse. I was actually, I was working sanitation in Westchester. And, you know, I was starting at 6 o'clock in the morning. I was getting out at 10 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, I had a lot of time on my hands from 10 o'clock in the morning on. And, I started going to bars. I started drinking with guys that were about, you know, 20 or 30 years older than I was. And I'm looking left, looking right, looking left. And, you know, I just knew something was up. And, you know, but a lot of my, like I told you, a lot of people in my family are drinkers too. And a lot of my close friends today still, you know, they're still, you know, alcohol is still, you know, number one to them. And so it was hard to make that decision. And, I was still lost. You know, I started talking to my friends, and I started looking around, and I started asking them. I was asking the wrong people for help. What it was, I was asking for help in bars and, you know, after hour clubs, and you know, they were just saying, you know, stick to beer. And so, you know, I tried that, and a couple of shots later, you know, there I was again, and I started wetting the bed, and I was waking up in my own urine every day. And that would happen every time I drank now. And, you know, I knew I was getting sick. My friend's dad's a doctor. And he said, you know, there's something wrong. And, you know, you got to do something. And, you know, a friend that came tonight, he's sitting in the back. I knew he was in the program. And I told him, you know, listen, I need help. And I had the phone, like, you know, about 2 feet away. And I said, I need help. And I don't know what he said, where to go. And I couldn't hear him. But he ended up... you know, he took me to my first meeting, and he opened up the door, and, you know, it was tremendous. Well, at first, it was hard. My sobriety date's March 23rd, 2002, so that was a couple of years ago. And, yeah, I just remember when I came in, I was very angry. And, you know, everything wasn't peaches and cream. You know, everyone, you know, some people didn't come up to me, and, you know, some people came up to me and asked me if I wanted to go bowling or go to the diner. And I told them, you know, I'd rather go watch my ceiling fan turn around and around than do that. And, it sounded like it'd be a lot cooler than that, you know. So, diners and bowling wasn't for me. So, you know, but that anger caught up to me real fast. And, you know, I changed. And about a year down the road, I changed. I started asking for help. And, you know, I got a great sponsor. A lot of people here know him, Max. And he got sober at a young age. And, you know, he's a great guy. And I'm glad that, you know, I walked into that meeting and he grabbed me. You know, sobriety has been, you know, hasn't been easy street all the way, but it's definitely worth it. My cousin, I tried to take in last year. I tried to recruit him, and it didn't work out so good. And, you know, I thought I could get him sober. And I learned first, you know, you can't do that. It's a very important lesson. You can't get anybody sober. I can tell you that because I ended up knocking him out one night. And, you know, a cop police officer that I grew up with was there, and he ended up telling me, you know, I can't put my hands on people. And that's where it took me. You know, I was sober two and a half years when that happened. And, you know, here I am beating people up. And, yeah, he was drunk, so it wasn't that hard. But, you know, anyway, it was just, you know, it was hard to see that because I know that there's an answer and, you know, it's to come here. But, you know, you got to want it, you know. And, you know, ever since then, you know, I learned a lot. You know, you learn from your mistakes, obviously. And, you know, I sponsored people that went out. And, you know, I'm like, how can they do this? What, you know, and I just, you know, I just remember that I'm sober. And that's all that, you know, that all that it's really what matters to me right now. You know, if I stay sober, you know, I can help that other alcoholic. And that's what I'm going to focus on now. My sponsor's really big on that, talking to the newcomer. You know, because I was a newcomer not too long ago. And that's, you know, sometimes I'm a little shy, so I don't always go up to that, you know, that guy all the time. And so, you know, from now on, you know, I'm learning to walk up to the new guy and say, listen, you know, here's my number. You know, my name's Steve, and, you know, I know how you feel. And, you know, that's basically it. And hopefully down the road, you know, I'm still young, 25. You know, I can help that young guy that's coming in. And, you know, because I was thinking I was the young guy that, you know, I thought I was too young. And then that wasn't the case. And, you know, but from now on, it's, you know, I definitely have to focus more on the book. You know, my sponsor talked to me about that the other night. And, you know, I haven't opened up the book in a while. And I definitely think that's, you know, very important. You know, that's basically all I have. And I just want to thank you guys again for letting me speak. And that's it. Thanks.
The main speaker tonight is Eva C.
Thank you. I think it should be a little taller, maybe, you know? Okay. Hi, my name is Eva, and I'm an alcoholic. And one of these days, I'm going to get my name said right. I know it. Eva Coppola, by the way. This is my badge of honor right here. Thank you. Yeah, thanks. My first sober day is April Fool's Day, 1990. My sponsor's name is Rena. This is one of the groups that I call home. And I'm living in 10, 11, and 12. And this is great. This is really, 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 really nice. This is awesome. So I have to say thanks to Stacy. And now, as I understand it, now that I'm on the roster of AG speakers, you can refer to me as Her Eminence. And nothing. It's, yeah. And according to Stacy, I'm a circuit speaker now. So, yeah. So every time Stacey's seen me for the last 3 months, he's been calling me Circuit Speaker. He said he saw me on circuitspeakers.com as well. And anyway, so I see you here every week, and I'm reminded how fortunate I am in my friends. And I never would have had this if 15 years ago I hadn't decided to choose this path. Hey, it's Flag Day. So, wave a flag. we're such New Yorkers, we don't even care. Like, what's Flag Day? What is that? Anyhow, I've had a lot of time to think about what I wanted to say to you tonight. And since Stacy asked me 3 months ago, so I've been thinking about it every day for 3 months. So I was born on the steppes of Russia, carried in swaddling clothes and smuggled into Western Europe, brought up by a governess in solitude in a castle in the south of France, whereupon at the age of 21, I was released on my own recognizance to New York City. No, that's not how it happened. I drank inappropriately from the first... Never tell that joke again. No. I drank inappropriately from the first time I ever drank, and I'm an alcoholic since kindergarten. And I know that because I have an episode that starts in kindergarten. And also, I've gotten to learn, you know, that this is hereditary, and my family's full of it. My granny died of it. I was there with her when that was happening. I was given instructions on how to deal with when she had convulsions, what I would do. And I didn't know, of course, at the time. I was 12 or 13 or early teens. My father still has it, and I grew up in a really abusive. My life was full of abuse growing up, but you know, it's just different now. And I'll talk a little bit about that forgiveness, real forgiveness, when I talk more about sobriety. So anyway, my father still has this disease, and the miracle of being sober and being around is what this does for us and what this does for our lives and how this pervades our lives. And he may get sober, and that's amazing. He may choose this life, and that's incredible. And that's only due to, well, it's just due to what God does with us here. We bring God here, and we make God a reality here with us in our relationships, and we teach each other how to, we take care of our spirits. We come here, and we care for our spirit. I had a chip on my shoulder the size of Mount Vesuvius. I just drank, I just drank alcoholically and PO'd a lot of people. Wine was for pansies. I thought that that really wasn't interesting to me. I was interested in the hard stuff from the very beginning. My kindergarten story is, I'm a product of an Eastern European family and an Italian Catholic family, so I've got, step right up. I've got guilt for all of you. Yeah, so the Gottliebs and the Coppolas decided to join forces, I suppose, and, excuse me. And then I came along. lots of tempers but it's funny, like the Gottliebs, that side of the family didn't have a lot of drinking, but the Italians did. And my grandfather loved to make wine. He was very proud of his wine, and the stuff was dreadful. But, he made it in the basement, and it was like, oh, I've got wine, I'm Italian, I'm from Calabria. And, it's like, it's really kind of funny. If you pardon me, Stacy, for those of you who were there on Sunday, Stacy spoke about Rufus. I have the committee of Eva is a loser, so why bother living? Why bother living? So they've got the big L ready to stamp on my forehead, and they sound something like this. And they're there every morning, so if I don't do certain things, I listen to them. They say, good morning, fatty. That's because you're too lazy to get yourself to the gym. What else? Oh, you're not very smart, and you're not particularly attractive. And look at you, you'll be 37 in a couple of months, and what have you done with your life? You're not getting any younger. And everyone can see on your freakishly oversized butt that piece of cake you ate last year. And your third grade teacher still regrets having you in class. And nobody likes you at AG. They won't find your jokes funny, and they will walk out when you speak. Yeah. So you might as well just pack it in, because there's no hope for you. So, that doesn't really work very well, that whole logic. That logic gets me right to, Sambuca and vodka, which was my first and last love. I just loved it. Popov, Georgie, they were all my friends. So what do? I do my prayers every morning. Before I do anything else, I get on my knees and I get in a position that's, I think it's called the Sajda position. But anyway, it's the Muslims pray this way. They put their heads on the floor. They prostrate themselves. So I found that this really works the best. So I do that every single morning before I do anything else, and I say the same prayer, and it works. And I say gratitude, and I go through the gratitude list and make a point of examining that. Because if I don't do that, then I'm just going to go out and get whacked. And I don't want to get whacked anymore. I like living. I like coming and seeing you. I like coming and getting hugged by you. I love every single person. You come up to me every week and you say, hi, Eva, I'm so happy to see you. And you give me a hug and you shake my hand and you tell me that I do something for you in your life. And I would not do without that. And I wanted that so badly when I was drunk. And I tried to find it in a bar and I could never find it in a bar. It wasn't there. So I'm an alcoholic since kindergarten. So how is that possible? Well, it's hereditary. So there I was in kindergarten, and I was drinking this thing called Malta, which my parents gave to me for lunch every day, which some of you may know what it is, but if you don't, it's fine. So it's kind of a light beer, it's referred to as a soft drink, which it is not. I had this Malta, and I remember, I really I know I'm an alcoholic. Oh, because I got sober before I was 22. So there's this really stinking thinking that can happen where I can start to think, oh, well, maybe I don't really have a problem, and, you know, maybe I can handle it, and it wasn't really that bad, and I didn't lose a house, and I didn't go to jail, and I didn't kill anyone, and I didn't crash. I crashed cars, actually. I drove drunk and did things with cars, but I never hurt anyone that way. So there's this really insidious kind of thing that can happen, like, oh, well, you know, maybe I can have a little something. And, you know, that just can't happen. And I just don't want it, and I just love being sober. It took a while in sobriety to love life. I learned to love life. You taught me how to love life. And I'm loving life, and I'm going to tell you about that. But anyway, so, yeah, and champagne's kind of a tricky one, too. I see these champagne ads sometimes, and it's important to talk about this stuff. Just say, you know, yeah, I see you, you see me, that's fine, you're cute, but you're not that cute. Thanks. You know, thanks for sharing. I'm moving on. Goodbye now, you know. And what my sponsor says about the committee, oh, that's a good thing, too. My sponsor says about the committee, yeah, so make sure that you let the committee know that you say, yeah, okay, thanks for sharing, bye now, because I have to go live my life. And that's really useful. And the other thing is that by me sort of laying the committee out and being really honest and just telling the truth and just saying what they are, they're not so scary anymore. You know, this disease, it's like a boogeyman. It really is. And if we don't talk about the boogeyman, it gets really scary. And if we don't talk to somebody and say, hi, I'm really scared, it gets bigger and worse and uglier and more vicious. And then we just say, I can't do this. I can't handle this. I can't live. I'll just have a drink. Because that's just easier. You know, I could just live that way. And that's the lie. That's the big lie. For those of you counting days, believe me, there's nothing more out there. There's nothing more out there. It's all here. We've got it. We all share it. It's all here. You don't have to do any more experimentation. Please don't, because we'd like you to come back. So my Malta story, I'm there, I'm drinking this Malta, and I've got this bit of a swagger. I remember I even had this kind of a swagger. And it's, you know, I was four. I had it, where did this... So, you know, it's in my DNA. I'm an alcoholic. It's in my DNA. And there I am. And I'm waiting for this person to come to me in a meeting somewhere. I'm waiting for him to say, I was that kid. And the thing is, what's interesting is nobody else said anything except for this child. So he was as precocious as I was because I have a distinct recollection of this event. There I was sitting there. I remember the dress I was wearing. I remember, oh... Yeah, I remember kind of what the room looked like. I was sitting on a beanbag chair. So I was in kindergarten. It was, the early 70s, beanbag chair. And I'm drinking this Malta. And he looks at me, and he kind of turns his head to the side, and he says, hey, doesn't that have alcohol in it? And I just was infuriated. How dare you? How dare he? I remember thinking that. How dare you question me about my drinking? I remember thinking that. I was four. Where does a four-year-old get this stuff? I never met a drink I didn't like. I mean, vodka was my first and last love, but I never met a drink I didn't like. But I was just into the hard stuff, as I said before. I wasn't, you know, wine was just sort of, you know, you're boring me. Give me something real. That can only come from this disease, too, because there was never a time when I was really interested in anything but shots. Like, I loved shots. I was a shot drinker. So I loved Red Devils. So, remember Red Devils? Yeah, they were fun. I really messed up my stomach on those things, though, because sometimes they put Tabasco sauce in them. And I was a really big shot about having shots. I would go into a bar with intent. I entered a bar with intent to drink you all under the table and walk out. And as I walked out, give you, you know, a... gesture, which I won't do because we're not allowed here, but you know what I'm talking about. And I wanted to walk into that bar, and I wanted to be dressed from head to toe in skin-tight leather and stiletto heels and walk in there, and that's, you know, that's what I get dressed up, and I only wore black. It was it that was only black, and walk in and, like, put my thing down on the bar and be known. That was my thing. You know me. Look at me. That's watch me. And, so was the attitude. I had the hubris. And the thing is, with the abuse and the way that my life was when I was growing up, I had tons of anger. I had tons of excuses. I had loads of excuses to get whacked. And it wasn't an excuse, because I just loved to escape. That was the thing. And I did love the taste of alcohol, but, a lot of things taste good. A lot of things taste good. So it wasn't really about how much I loved the taste of alcohol. It was what it did to me. And I needed it to do it to me because I had this pain that I didn't know where it came from. But it was ridiculous, this pain. This pain was bigger than the planet. This pain was so bad, and there was nothing that would stop it. Nothing, except getting drunk. So if I got whacked, I wouldn't have to feel this pain. I wouldn't have to hate myself so much. I wouldn't have to hate you so much. And it was terrible. But that was how I dealt with life. That was how I dealt with existing. And I was a very glamorous drinker, too. yeah. I mean, if all you had was beer, I'll take it. But I always claim that, I'd only drink top shelf. But if Popoff was all you had, I'll take it. Yeah. So I'm reminded with Popoff, I remember I was in college, and... So here I was going through high school, and... The thing was, I wasn't allowed to go out because I was really, I was dealing with my father being the way he was. I was kind of a prisoner, and I wasn't allowed to go out. I wasn't allowed to socialize, and I was a highly unsocialized child. Oh, right. This is interesting. Third grade. So I was in third, so I'm sorry I'm backing up a little bit, but I was in third grade, and there I was, and you may remember the game Dodgeball. So we threw... You just throw the ball at somebody's head, and that's supposed to be funny, and, right. So there I was in this game of dodgeball. And, I was always the unpopular kid. They never picked me for the team. I was always the last. And then if I was left, they were like, oh, my God, she's on our team. Ugh! This kind of thing. So I'd be on the team. They hated me. They didn't want me. And I hated myself. So it kind of worked out that way. So there I was, and this one... child in the class had marked me. I don't know. He, whatever. So I was his target. So he just with all of his strength, he took this ball and threw it directly at my head. Just with all of it. So I was screaming and crying and a mess and wrecked, and I go running off and I stop playing and I'm going off into the side and in the gymnasiums that we had when we were growing up, they had these pile of these exercise mats. So I throw myself onto the pile and I was such a drama queen, I was like, throw myself onto this pile of mats, and I'm total tantrum, and my teacher, my third grade teacher, comes to try to talk to me, and I'm throwing a fit, and I said, well, I don't understand it. Why are they doing this to me? And that's why I said it. And she said, well, she took a minute. She paused. Maybe it's the way you're saying me. That drove me out. I hated her. I hated her. I kind of continued that way into my 20s. I continued that way. That's how I functioned. That's how I lived. I was unsocialized. I couldn't have, it says in the big book that we alcoholics are incapable of having a healthy relationship with another human being. And I was classic. Continued like that. I got into a relationship with somebody who was 20 years older than me. I was 19 at the time. Oh, right. So I left home. I ran away from home finally because I couldn't deal with the insanity. And that was kind of a self-preservation. But the people I picked to live with were great, great choice. I picked one cokehead and one alcoholic. That worked out really well, and I was so much fun that they asked me to leave after about a month. Yeah, so I was really a great person to live with. You know, one of them thought he was my boyfriend, and I let him think that while I flirted shamelessly with the other one who couldn't stand me. So, you know. So they asked me to leave, so I was without a home. But the interesting thing, God is always there. And when I look at my life and I look at my history, God is always there. And my granny died of this disease, and I was at her funeral, and I got drunk at her funeral, of course. And, you know, I was drunk at her wake, of course. And, you know, they had whiskey, so I just took that because that works out. And, right. So she had left some money for me, and I knew she'd left some money for me. So when I had this, I was homeless, and I was 19. And, so I called my parents and I said, listen, I know that there's some money for me, and I want it. Give me my due. So they did. And it was just enough money for me to get the apartment that I got. It was exactly the amount of money required. Okay, so that was the beginning of the end. I felt that at that point, well, I can finally drink the way I want to. I don't have to have anybody questioning me. I don't have to have anybody giving me a hard time. So I made my grocery list, and it was vodka and beer and orange juice. And the orange juice was optional. And it was fine. You know, I went to the local place. I got the 12-pack of beer and made sure I had vodka always. Oh, yeah, right. Oh, boy, I'm not going to get through this. No way. Okay, I really would love to tell you this college story very quickly. When I was in high school and we were taking driving class, our teacher said to us, again, I really believe that this is God talking. Teacher said, when you have a blackout, that's as close to death as a living person can be. Now, this driving teacher knew that there was a tremendous amount of drinking going on at our age. That I mean, I wasn't a part of it because I drank at home and I couldn't go out and I was kind of a prisoner. But the drinking was excessive, to say the least. So he said this because he knew that we'd all be driving. And he says, so listen, a blackout is as close to death as a living person can be. And that's all he said. And that stuck with me. And so I'm in college, and we're at this party, and I'm dating this. I'm sort of dating. I don't know this guy Jim. I've chosen him to be the one with whom I will lose my virginity because I was 19 and I was full of shame, and like, you know, I was in high school. What? You're still a virgin? I was like, I couldn't deal with it. So I picked somebody, and we used to skip class and go drink Sambuca, and then, you know, go like in his car. You know, I thought that was cool, and that's alcoholic. And but also interestingly, I was Phi Theta Kappa while I was in college. So I was getting whacked, and I was at the top of my class. So I don't have a problem, because look, I'm Phi Theta Kappa, which is the 2-year version of Phi Beta Kappa, by the way. I was in the top 10% of the country with my grades. We go to this party, and we don't have much money, so we get this huge thing of Popov, and we decide that we're going to do shots, and we're sitting there, and we decide that a shot is like this much in a juice glass, which is it's like 2 shots. And I'm throwing them down, and I think I'm really cool. And then we start mixing it with Hawaiian Punch, and I'm drinking that, and I think I'm really cool. And the thing is also, alcohol dehydrates you, by the way. So I got really thirsty, and I didn't know why. And so I just sort of tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, gee, and I hadn't stood up for about an hour, or maybe 2 hours or something. So I'm feeling a little parched. So I get up, and I don't remember anything else. I come to, I'm in the bathroom, I'm seeing Hawaiian Punch again. And then I'm out again, and then I wake up again, and I'm still in the bathroom, and then I'm out again. Then I wake up again, and they're all shaking me, and they're like, Eva, Eva, you have to get up. You're going to be late. Your father will kill you, blah, blah. So the only thing missing from this scene was the shopping cart. They didn't wheel me up in a shopping cart, although they should have. Instead, they're driving back, and the windows are down. It's winter. I'm in Pelham Manor. This is where I was at the time when I was in college. And I'm wearing this stupid, thin, crappy varsity jacket thing. And the windows are rolled all the way down. And we're going 70 on the, or something, speeding on the highway because they're speeding to get me back. And the wind is blowing in my face. And I can barely stay awake. So that's why I bring up this thing about a blackout is as close to death as a human, as a living person can be. Because I could barely stay awake with that freezing wind blowing at 60 or 70 miles an hour on my face. But I didn't think I had a problem. There was no problem. Okay, so I get back, and I swear to my father for 45 minutes that I'll never drink again. Say it with me, I'll never drink, you know. Meanwhile, I decided that, no, I will never get caught again, but I will drink the way I want to. And you can, you know, hit the road. So, fine. But I had a hangover for a week. And I decided that Jim was a problem, and I had to get rid of Jim. So Jim and I were sharing a locker at the time, and the next day, whenever the next school day was, I go back into college, and I say, "Listen, take your stuff out of the locker. I don't want to talk to you. Don't call me. I don't want to talk to you. What's the matter? I just, you know, you're trouble. You know, you got me. You're trouble." So, I mean, ultimately, the lesson here is that throughout with every single thing, I just at no point had any idea or concept that I was an alcoholic and that alcohol was the problem. The people were the problem, or the place was the problem, or the school was the problem, or whatever it was, or you were being mean to me, or whatever it was. But it was never alcohol. So I'm in my 20s, and I get into this relationship, and I decide I'm going to be the other woman. And I'm now in my apartment, you know, my wonderful apartment where I'm on the floor, and oh gosh, I have 5 minutes. Woohoo! Okay, so talk about sobriety. Yeah. Okay, well, that's fine. You know, I've told you enough about the drunkalog. Those of you who can find this useful, I hope you can. I'm trying to give you my history here, and there's a lot. So, sobriety is the most beautiful thing that I know of. It's the most divine thing that I know of. And it's the greatest happiness that I know of. And you are the loveliest people that I know of. And you're the best friends I have. And I wouldn't trade for anything. And you make me laugh. I get to laugh with you. I get to laugh hard and loud. I get to go to movies and laugh loud with my friends, my sober friends. I get to be silly. I get to laugh at myself. I learned how to laugh at myself. There's a cautionary tale about sobriety that I'd like to offer, too. I don't get sober because I think that I'm going to get everything I want. Because I didn't get everything I want. And I didn't get sober thinking that I would get it. That's lucky. Because if I had thought I was going to get everything I want, I would be drunk already. And I'd probably be dead. And my parents would be very sad people. And I don't want to do that to them. Because I love them. And we have a good relationship now. Thanks to sobriety. Thanks to this program. Forgiveness is the key to serenity. I talk about this, but there's no time to talk about this now. But real forgiveness. Because my father was really a monster. And he's not a monster now. You know, he's just a man. I love him. He's my father and I love him and that's it. But I lost everything when I had 12 years. And I looked up to God and I said, "God, as I understand you, who are you? Why did you do this to me? I didn't get sober for this. I didn't get sober to lose everything." So here's the deal. We get sober to be sober. We get sober because we get to heal the spirit. We get sober so we can learn how to be in life and love life for what it is. We get sober so we know how to show up and be there long enough for those doors to open. I'm seeing doors open now, and it's so incredible. Wow, okay, I didn't know I was going to get emotional. Okay, this is amazing. I'm having an experience of life right now that I simply never imagined I would get to have. Okay? I had to lose everything at 12 years, and I had to go through hell, real hell, sober. And what you said to me was, "Please come back. We love you. We want to see you tomorrow. We need to see you tomorrow. You belong here. So I did. I said, okay, fine. I will bet on you. If you're counting days, bet on us. Don't go to the racetrack. Don't go to the bar. Bet on us. And I promise you that at some point, you will see that bet realized. But you will see it realized to a degree that is impossible to predict or imagine. So all I can say is we're here when we get sober to understand that we're here long enough to be sober and alive and present when those doors start to open and when those opportunities are available. My life is not falling apart anymore. My life is coming together. It feels like the universe opened up. I don't know, but this is God. This is what happens. And I'm going with it. And I'm saying, I wake up every day, and I get on my knees, and I say, thank you, God. And whatever happens, gratitude is first. There's something that... one thing that I think is kind of funny. My first sponsor, checked herself into a psychiatric and emotional healing place. Because I was such a joy. She intuitively knew how to handle a situation that baffled her. Me. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I was the cause, but anyhow. Yeah. So in closing, it's been said, I've heard this said here, and I was told that Van also says this, but I heard it from somebody else, and anyway. Why does the American Indian rain dance work? Because they don't stop dancing until it rains. So let's keep dancing. Thank you.